Okay. We probably could have just recorded all of that. I don't know if it would pick up. But all of that was to illustrate for all of us, as well as especially for the kids. Of course, around here, we have two dominant languages. We have English and we have Spanish. And we all know what that's like when you are trying to talk to somebody that does not speak your language and you're trying to relate what you need. I work down at the library once in a while, and you have people that come in and they want to get a book and they're trying to tell you what they want and I don't understand, and I'm trying to tell them what I need from them and they don't understand me, and I pull up my computer and type in English and find Spanish translation on Google and I try to read it to them, and they're looking at me like, because it's like Ben said, butchered Italian. You know, well, I sometimes swing the thing around and then they kind of giggle like, oh, that's what you were trying to say. Okay, sure. And then they look at actually a translation of it, and then they know what they want. And then I give them the keyboard and I have them type back, and that's the way we type back and forth with that. All because way back at the Tower of Babel, over 4,000 years ago, man tried to resist or tried to do what God told them to do. They did not want to obey God. They did not want to do what God wanted. And as a result, God confused their languages, and we are still stuck with that today. I actually tried, interestingly enough, for one of the slides here, I tried to find something. There were two companies, a combination of IBM and Lockheed Martin, that like 15 years ago, I believe it was, had an ad in a number of magazines that was said, undoing the Babel effect. That was part of their goal. They're trying to bridge this communication gap that we have around the world and trying to help everybody to understand each other. They want a universal translator like Captain Kirk had in Star Trek or something like that. This is what's going on. But it started, as we saw last week, if you have your Bibles and open to Genesis 10, it started with a man by the name of Nimrod. Now, let's ask a couple of questions and see how many of you can remember these things as we get to there. First of all, number one, what did God tell Noah to do when they got off the ark? Okay. Multiply and spread out. Fill the earth. Okay. So that's what they were told to do. Okay. Now, Noah had three sons. Can anybody name the three sons of Noah?
Yep.
Okay, somebody in Peggy's class, what are Noah's three sons? Japheth, okay. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Thank you. Okay. One of those sons sinned. One of those sons did something really bad. What was his name? Does anybody remember?
Ham.
Okay. Ham did something that he really was not supposed to do. And one of Ham's descendants had the name, this guy right here, Nimrod. So Nimrod came from part of the family of Noah that was cursed. Okay? And Nimrod, we're told in Genesis chapter 10, we looked at this last week, it says in verse 8, now Cush became the father of Nimrod. Does anybody remember what Nimrod means? One of you kids, first of all. Yes?
Rebel.
Or rebel, or we will rebel, okay? So could you imagine if you named your child, we talked about this last week, could you imagine if you named your child, we will rebel? You know, I used Nathaniel last week, okay? That imagine what he would think if every time his parents called him, they say, gift of God, come here, gift of God, come here, gift of God. Because Nathaniel to us means nothing in English, it's just a name. But if you were a Hebrew speaker and you had the name Nathaniel, every time you heard it, you're hearing, gift of God. Well, could you imagine a child being raised? We will rebel. Come here. We will rebel. Go get milk for your mother. We will rebel. Clean up your room.
Sometimes I could call Emily that.
We will rebel.
Rebel.
And so we have this man by the name of Nimrod in verse 8 of Genesis 10. Cush became the father of Nimrod. He became a mighty one on the earth. He was our Bible say a mighty hunter before the Lord, but we talked about that. What was he hunting? He's hunting people. Whose people? What kind of people? He's hunting God's people. Can you imagine somebody out in the earth that they become famous because they're hunting God's people? And it goes on, and it says, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Kalna in the land of Shinar. Shinar is over in eastern Iraq. It's kind of where Babylon is and down into Ur, down as you're heading down towards Kuwait and all that. It's that part of the world. And it goes on, and from that land he went forth into Assyria and built Nineveh. Do we think of Nineveh with a good sense when we think of Nineveh? No. We think of a city that God had to send Jonah to. And the city repented under Jonah's teaching, and within 100 years they were right back where they were, and God brought a flood and leveled the city, brought its destruction about. And then he mentions two others there in connection with this. And so, this is Nimrod. This man is basically creating a world empire in that part of the world at that time that is all about rebelling and revolting against God. And so in chapter 11 now today, turn to chapter 11 in your Bibles, Genesis 11. We're going to come to this next part where we're going to look at what the people do and what the people did. And in verse 1 it says, and now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. And it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. So as we said, here's an example. Here's the land of Shinar. This is what we know today as part of, most of it is part of Iraq. And so they settle over there. It's largely flat ground. That's one of the things, that this was a plain. And so they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they used bricks for stone and they used tar for mortar. And they said, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top literally is in the heavens. And let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. So their goal is, let's all stay together. Let's build a city. Let's build a tower. Let's make a name for ourselves. We want to be somebodies. We just met some relatives of the Canes that came the other night. And the wife is from the Tri-Cities. Grew up her whole life in the Tri-Cities. And when she met her husband, she was like, Royal City, where's that? Now, sometimes I'm down in the Tri-Cities and somebody will start talking with somebody and they say, oh, where do you live? Royal City. And they're like, I heard that name. Kind of up by Othello. Yeah, you're good. That's fine. You know, if you're over in Seattle, where are you from? Royal City. And occasionally if there are maybe people that travel to WSU, they go, oh, yeah. But a lot of people like, I don't know. So I usually don't even say Royal City. I say, oh, a little south and west of Moses Lake. Oh, because they know that. But Royal City, hardly anybody knows the name of Royal City. But if I were to go over there and I were to say, I'm from Seattle, people go, oh, I know who you are. If I'm from New York. Oh, you're a New Yorker. We know you people. You have a reputation. If you're from Seattle, you've got a reputation that you're a greenie because you got moss on your growing on your back. No, you've got all kinds of reputation for being a greenie for other things. And you're a tech city. If you're from New Yorker, I don't know what they think about that, but you have a reputation. See, so different cities have a reputation, and that is what these people want, is they want a name, they want a reputation, they want fame that comes with establishing themselves in a city. And so they decide here, these four things that he has, that they are going to build a city for themselves, they're going to build a tower, and when it says they're going to build a tower with its top in the heaven, they're talking about learning to communicate with gods. Now, I don't have this on the outline, but I want to show you, I believe, what Paul tells us is going on in this setting. So look in your Bibles quickly over to Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. Josh was talking to us a little while ago. We had that arm of that Catholic saint that the Catholics revere. Think about that. Rather than just believing what the Bible says and just believing in Jesus Christ, they come and they think they're closer to God by getting, you know, that close through glass to the severed arm of a saint. His body is actually still enshrined also in a glass case. They actually, I'd seen some video where they can see the rest of us. And you know, and this is an interesting thing I found about this. They actually had monks that they intentionally took that arm off. They took that arm off so that it could travel around. See? Because they've created a religion, and most of us don't think of that. We think of Catholics as just being, well, they're just pretty much like us. They are not just like us. They are people that believe in salvation by baptism. They are people that believe in salvation by taking the seven sacraments. They are people that believe in the veneration of angels and saints. And they believe that you cannot go directly to Jesus Christ, but that you have to go to Mary and have her intercede to her son. So you need to understand, there is a vast difference between Catholicism and what the Bible teaches for Christianity. Are there some things that Catholics are orthodox on? Yes. But they've got some really significant problems when it comes to the doctrine of salvation and how you and I live.
When you say there's something orthodox,
orthodox means they're straight on. So they're straight in terms of what does the Bible teach on this? So do they believe in the Trinity? Oh yeah, they believe in the Trinity. Do they believe in the death of Christ? Yes. Do they believe in the resurrection of Christ? Yes. But their salvation is not based on that alone. Okay. Now that's just one example. I can say, I always have to throw us in the mix here because I know a lot of Baptist churches that they're not a whole lot different. They may not have seven sacraments, they may not venerate saints, but they have other serious issues with regard to the doctrine of salvation. But what happens now, I'm using the example of people worshiping that hand. If you go back probably to this time, about the time that they come off the ark, we are told in Romans chapter 1 and verse 17, Romans 1 and verse 17, "For in it, that is in this gospel, a righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, that the righteous shall live by faith. For a quality of God's wrath is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness in the men who hold down the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which is known about God is plainly evident for them, for God has made it evident to them." In other words, if you look at creation and you look at what you can see out there, there is evidence all over in that about who God is. It says, verse 20, "Since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature," or it should be everlasting power, "they are clearly seen." In other words, it took an immense amount of power to create this universe, number one. And number two, it's not just power just thrown out there. You could take, they were talking about this with magnets the other night. You can take magnets and you can create these things that the military uses called rail guns. And you, with a giant magnet, they can hurl large projectiles great distance. That's a tremendous amount of power. But when those things land, they don't put things in order. They land and they cause chaos. He says here that it is not just his power, but his divine nature, meaning that there was intelligence in the exercise of that power so that things are ordered. So that the cells, when a mother conceives a child, those cells begin to replicate in a fashion designed by God, and within a short space, it doesn't take very long. When you have something, if you look at it, you go, "That's a baby! It may be just this big, but it's a baby!" You can tell it. And that heart starts beating in a short space of time. And that's not an accident. That's not chaos. That's actually design. And you plant a seed in the ground, and guess what? You plant a whole bunch of these seeds out there, and you get these trees. And they all produce the same fruit. And they all put the same leaves and the same kind of blossoms. That's order. And so he says here that they could have looked at creation, and they would have been able to see that these things exist. And they're clearly seen, being understood though what has been made, or through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. Then he goes on. "For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God, or did they give him thanks, but they became futile or vain in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God." There was a reason God told Israel, "Don't make any images of me." Because God's a spirit being. He doesn't exist in a body, contrary to Mormonism. God is a spirit being without a body. Can he manifest himself in a form? Yes, he can. But that's not his normal existence. And they take that the image of the incorruptible God of him, and they represent it in the image of corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. We'll go back over there to Genesis chapter 11. What happens, what begins to happen on the Tower of Babel. So, I'm just trying to look at this. Well, she made a man up here. They made a man. They've got windows. Okay, I didn't know if they put anything else in there. Because it says it's top in the heavens. But very likely what this was, the Tower of Babel, whether it looked like this or not, it was designed for them to be worshiping the stars. Because that's where they thought gods were. And it's not an accident that what we have today, what is called, what we know as the zodiac, and zodiac is thousands of years old, that in that zodiac is always representing what? Creatures. What's Pisces? It's fish. It's fish. What's Leo? He's a lion. What's Taurus? It's a bull. What's Scorpio? Scorpion. What's the crab? I can't remember what it's called. Sagittarius. So all these things and many more things. There's in the sky, there's the great swan. There's all of these things. And you can go back in history, way back, and people have told stories about these stars up there because they believed that all of these things actually represented gods. It's not just that you're born under the sign of Pisces, it's the fact that it's the fish god. That actually you're born under his sign. And it's the fish god that has something to do with your life. And this is the foolishness that comes. And so when it tells us back here that they build a city with its top in the heaven, the Tower of Babel was about worshiping false gods. It's about worshiping false gods. It's about trying to connect with the world outside of our world as they saw it. Then we saw thirdly that they wanted to make a name for themselves and they did not want to disperse. Now here, this is a 15th century painting. There's about three or four different ones that all are very similar in what they thought the Tower of Babel looked like. Again, we don't know. And the Orth kids, their tower resembles very much this idea here. But it's a tower communicating with God. In fact, remember the name Babel meant gate of God or God's gate, because they believe that by this city and where this tower is going to be located, it would give them access to God. But there are other possibilities, okay? This is one of the ziggurats down in Ur. This is one of the ziggurats, and there's a whole bunch of these ziggurats throughout parts of Iraq or that part of the world. But what to me, and then this was another one, this is where they actually have rebuilt some of the facade of one of these ziggurats over there.
That's the one in Ur.
This is the one in Ur. Yeah, this one is near there, but it's not the one in Ur. Okay, and Ur, remember, what is Ur famous for? Who came from Ur?
Who came from Ur?
The city Ur. Abraham came out of Ur. Okay, he was called out of Ur of the Chaldeans, which, by the way, does anybody know what? Going back to this idea of the tower being communicated with God, does anybody know what the name Chaldean means? Does anybody remember? Stargazers. Yeah. It's an old Aramaic word that referred to stargazers. And they're not looking at the stars like my wife that thinks it's fun to go out there with her telescope and her charts and look at these stars. They're out there thinking that there's gods out there and that they can tell the future, that they can predict the future by looking at stars. Okay. Now the reason I have this little chart is because most of us, some of you, if you think about this, are probably aware of this, but all through kind of this central part of the world in here, we have essentially these towers of Babel. We have most probably famously in this area, but what do we have in Egypt? What do they call there? We call them pyramids. We have those when we get over to Indonesia and parts of Asia over here. We have pyramids. We have those when the Spaniards came into Mexico. What did they find? Essentially pyramids. Look at These are all just some of the most famous pyramids around the world. This one's in Mexico. We have Egypt. This one's in Iran, Iraq. This is in China. I don't know where that is. Cambodia and Indonesia. Some of us are very familiar with this one in Cambodia. But those are, what's showing you is that this idea that starts at Babel, even after this is over, people continue to carry this with them. They didn't forget what they started at Babel. God just stopped it from being a joint effort. Now it spreads. Now they're doing this as they're scattered throughout the world. But they continue to carry this idea. And in almost every case, these are all built about the worship of false gods. Okay? There are some of the temples or some of the Egyptian pyramids that are built as mausoleums to certain kings, which become a sort of a deity in Egypt. But the original, like the Great Pyramid Giza, had nothing to do with a particular king on the earth. It had to do strictly with star worship, is what that was about. In fact, for a long time, they've struggled with what the purpose of it was. Okay, at Babel, the people rebelled, as we already said. They wanted to make a name for themselves, and again, Babel has become notorious. In fact, we even use the word Babel, even as a modern term. And actually, it's not the word that we have in our Bibles. If you'd look in, let me see. I need to find the verse for us here. Look in chapter 11 of Genesis. Genesis chapter 11. And, it is verse 9. Therefore, the name was called Babel because there the Lord confused the language. And the word confused is not the word Babel, but it's the word Balal. Okay. Balal, which is Hebrew translation of an Aramaic term, which had to do with confusion. He created confusion in Balal. But Babel actually originally had meant, but Babel came, even though it started out as Gate of God, comes to end up having being associated with the idea of confusion, because that's what God did in there. Stop and think about what they're doing in there. Notice he says they don't want to be scattered over the earth in verse 5, and the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built, and the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language, and this is what they've begun to do, and now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Or literally, nothing will be restrained, or no one will restrain or hold back their hand. Now, can God hold them back? Yeah, he's going to confuse their language. God could do this kind of thing at any time. But the idea that God's getting at is, we don't step in and do this. These people are just going to develop the attitude that they never, ever have to think about doing what God says. And that's not God's purpose. He wants them scattered over the earth, and so he's going to force them to scatter over the earth. And I always think about these kind of ideas that people have. Resist together. Together we can do anything. Isn't that the way the world pictures wants us to grow up thinking about mankind? If we could just get everybody united, we get everybody together, we can accomplish anything. Or we shall not be moved. Isn't that what they're saying? We're not going to be moved. We all stay together, we won't be scattered. This is the nature of mankind. It comes out of the sin nature, but it's part of the deception, and it's something that the world system promotes. This is one of those places where the world system takes certain aspects of man's fallen nature and uses those things to promote this problem. And so as a result, God confused their languages. And we already saw that. So he goes on in verse 7 and says, come, let us go down and there confuse their language that they may understand or not understand one another's speech or one another's tongue or lip. And so then, now that their language is all confused and they can't speak, kind of like we had a very mini version of that down here with the kids. And I think one of the things you should keep in mind when we talk about this, we have in the same way that there's a dog and then there's all kinds of breeds of dogs, varieties of dogs, there's a lot of variations of languages where people, and Josh and Faye will tell you this, people on this side of the mountain speak this language. They can talk to the people over here, but they have lived in such isolation on either side of the mountain that these people over here, though their language is similar, also has developed certain ways of saying things, certain vocabulary that are different. And it's very likely as time goes on that maybe God, and this is just pure speculation on exactly how many, but maybe God divides all the people into 20 different languages. which that's a big deal, even if it's just 20. I'm not saying it's 20. Could have been 50. But those people, as they spread out and as they continue to spread out, those languages take on their own nuances. Any of you ever read Chaucer's Canterbury Tales? I've read it in a modern English translation. You try and pull out a translation from when it was first written, and you're going to go, what language is this? This isn't even English. Or my wife and I like to watch some British mysteries, and my wife always goes, I can't watch this with you. I can't understand what they're saying. Because they don't, on the television, they really don't sound like us. Of course, I've never been in person over there, so I don't know what it sounds like to be there. But the whole point is there's a diversity, you know? And so languages begin taking on a unique character wherever you go. We even live in our country right here. You live out here on the West Coast, you go up to the Northeast, in parts of Maine and such, you're going to listen to people speaking in English with an English dialect that at times you're going to go, what? What am I? Or there are certain parts, Frank Samro would have told you this, some parts where you go down into parts of Alabama and Louisiana down there that you're going to listen to people talk in a variety of English in which you're going to go, what? And you're not going to understand it. So it's just, even that is an example of the fact that as God confuses their language, you could take an English language and it can branch out into a lot of varieties of English. Okay. Just like if you go to China today, I think they actually recommend if you go to China, you should learn Mandarin, because it's probably the language that more people throughout China will understand, because there's so much diversity in those languages. And that's important for us to understand what God's doing, that it doesn't necessarily mean that he gives all those unique dialects initially, immediately, at the moment that he confuses their language. And so it starts here with God confusing their languages, and then it goes on and it says, they confuse the language, and then verse 8, so the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. The city ends. They don't finish that. And then it goes on and tells us, therefore, the name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. Now, we have two words that are used in this context. We have in verse 9, it says they're scattered, and we have the word puts in Hebrew. Puts, okay? Which you learn do all kinds of things to try to learn a foreign language. So when I studied Hebrew in seminary, you go with puts to scatter. It's like he puts them there, and he puts them there, and he puts them there. Okay, and that's the way I remember learning the word scatter. You go to verse 32 of chapter 10, and we have the word parad. Parad, and I never came up with a good, maybe you had a better thing, but I never came up with a good way to remember that. But that's the word that's translated separated on the earth after the flood. Now with that then, understanding those two terms, puts and parad are different. If you go back into chapter 10, if we go back up into chapter 10, and we go to verse 24, we have this Eber, and it says he has two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. So it tells us here in verse 25, his name is Peleg, for in his name day the earth was divided. And most or many modern translators come to this passage, and they look at Peleg, and they just think, well, this is all the people being scattered over the face of the earth. Notice what it says in verse 32. It says the nations were separated, parad. Notice in verse 8, it says, verse 9 of chapter 11, pardon me. Therefore, its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth, separated them, scattered them. So it's scattering the people, and in verse 32, he's separating the nations. But when we have verse 25, it says that in his days the earth was, and we have this word divided, and that's the verb form of the word peleg. And it's applied to the Hebrew term eretz, which is the physical planet, the earth, the ground. And interestingly enough, the term peleg, as we have up here, meant to divide by water. In fact, there's forms of the word peleg that are used elsewhere in the Old Testament of rivers and other bodies of water. What does that mean that he divides the earth and he uses peleg, a term meaning divide by water? What does that mean? Okay, it's this. It's this that happens in one man's lifetime. Just let that play out there. I remember learning this when I was in junior high. You know, Ben Orth teaches earth science. And you guys mention this, don't you? Continental drift, when you were teaching earth science. But what is the standard teaching on continental drift?
The standard is that kind of uniformitarianism that the earth is doing now and it's been doing for a long time. So separating centimeters per year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're measuring, as a friend of mine has said, they're measuring the movement of the earth by looking at a car that's been traveling on the interstate at 70 miles an hour, and it gets off at an exit and comes up to Dodson Road to stop, and they're measuring it as it's coming right up to the stop sign, which it's moving what? Incrementally. It's moving very slow compared to the 70 miles an hour it was doing when it was out on the interstate. That's what they're doing. They're looking at the earth or these continents having slowed down. In other words, in very simple terms, if we were to put that back together, and I'm not going to make you watch through that little GIF all over again, but it starts with all the earth being one, man's all in one place, God confuses their language, they scatter over the planet, and then after they're kind of spread out, then another way to make sure that they stay put, you just break the planet up and spread it out over the face of the earth. Which, by the way, important, I think, for us to understand, tells us that some of what we understand as modern geological features and such are things that transpired not because of the flood of Noah's day, but some of it transpired because of this. If you go to southern Oregon, there are what they call the Oregon Caves, south of Grants Pass. Very beautiful caves, if you ever have a chance to get there. And they have what they call, can't think of, their draperies, I can't remember, marble draperies in there, that were formed as the continental piece that we are on pushed up over this Pacific Rim plate, and it pushed over the top of coral reefs. That meant coral reefs had had time to develop before those two came clashing together, and it ground these things down under great heat and formed these beautiful coral reef marble draperies in there. They're really something to see. Of course, modern science says this took millions and millions and millions of years. The Bible says this transpired in one man's lifetime. Look over in chapter 11. Look in chapter 11 and verse 17. It says, and Eber lived 430 years after he became the father of Peleg, and he had sons and daughters. And Peleg lived 30 years, became the father of Reu, and Peleg lived 209 years after he became the father of Reu. So Peleg actually lives a total of 239 years. So in 239 years, God splits the planet up. And I've had different people say there's no way that the planet could have stood those continents moving that fast during one man's lifetime. Because, yeah, certainly God can't do that, can he? God doesn't have the ability to keep this thing together. No, he does. And he did it. And he did it in one man's lifetime. So there's three things that transpire. We have the nations that are separated. We have the people that are scattered. And we have the physical planet all split. All three of those being a form of judgment because man refused to do what God said. Refused to multiply, fill the earth, and multiply and fill the earth, as well as we saw last week, enforce their one rule, which was if a person kills somebody else, you put him to death. Now, with that then, as we move on here, as we finish this up, what do we expect? What should we think of when we think of this? Number one, we already talked about this last week. Man will always use laws and civil government to his own ends. In fact, did Israel end up doing that with their law? Yeah, we talked briefly about that last week. We're going to save that for when we get to the dispensation of law. But they ended up taking this law clearly given to them by God, and they twisted and manipulated that law into things that they could do. One of the passages I always think of is the Pharisees thought they were so noble enforcing the law and looking out for widows like they were supposed to, but Jesus accuses them, "You devour widows' houses." In other words, you've got those widows so strung out, you've got them so mortgaged so high to pay their bills and trying to help them out, that there's nothing left for them. And they did it all under the guise of keeping the law. Those were the kind of things that they did. In fact, they took the law, and as Jesus accused them of, you strap burdens on men's backs. But human government can never produce God's righteousness. In fact, even the Mosaic law, if you turn to Romans chapter 3 with me this morning, Romans 3, always be reminded of this, Romans chapter 3 and verse 20 when you get there. You'll have it read by the time I get there. Romans 3 and verse 20, it says, because out of law works, and he doesn't say the law, works of the law, he just says law works. So it could be this kind of law. In fact, later on in the book of Romans, he's going to talk about the Roman law. And he's going to compare it to the law of Israel, just to help them understand law in general. But he says in verse 20, it says, because from works of law, no flesh will be justified before him. For through law is a full experience of knowledge of sin. The main purpose God gave the law wasn't to make men righteous particularly. It was to help them realize what they couldn't do and to prove to them they were sinners. It's really important for us to understand the limitations of law. Even civil law, there are certain limitations in that. We looked last week over in Romans chapter 13, if you turn over there again. We saw that civil law, they do bear the sword, and the bearing of the sword, as we saw last week, was intended to do what? To enforce the law. And you don't brandish the sword around. Put it in modern terms today, why do state patrolmen and our city police, why do they carry a sidearm? So people can be impressed. Hey, what is that? You know, what caliber gun is that? How many are in the clip? You know, it's none of that at all. That is there to say, listen, if you don't abide by the law and you cause an immense amount of trouble or endanger me or somebody else, I have the means available to me to try to stop that. Our law enforcement officials are encouraged not to make that their first go-to, but they have that ability. It's not to brandish it around for showing off. And so, as we looked last week here in Romans chapter 13, for let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities. That's a really good lesson for us as Christians to remember. Because you know what? Sometimes we don't like the governments we live under. And I'm certain that Paul's readers didn't like the government they were living under. Probably even less than we do today. For there is no authority except from God. Keep that in mind. Even when you have certain people that are your representatives, different people representing you in government, who whatever position they may carry, you may have people that go, I like that guy, I voted for that guy, or I voted for that gal. But you're going to say, I didn't vote for him. And we as Christians could start the, not my president, not my representative, like these people do. But you know what? They're there because they were put there by God. That's a hard thing for us to remember, because we always are scratching our head going, how in the world can that person be put there by God? I don't get it. But Paul says they are, because God has a purpose in all of this. And those which exist are established by God. Therefore, he who resists the authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation on themselves. You fight against government, guess what? God isn't going to stand there and say, well, in fact, even if you do something because it's what God told you to do or not do. Good example, the book of Daniel. Daniel's three friends refused to bow down to an idol because God told them don't bow down to idols. He dictated that in the law. That was their rule. And so when they were told to do so by Nebuchadnezzar and his people, they refused to do so. So what? God said, well, you guys don't have to go to the fiery furnace. No, they had to go. And they even stood there and say, well, we don't even need to think about this. We don't even need a second to think about this. We are not going to bow down. And our God can save us from the fiery furnace. But even if he doesn't, see, they had no guarantee that God was going to protect them. They went in that fiery furnace. I honestly think those three guys thought God could save us, but we're probably going to die. I don't know that for sure, but they honestly say up front, God can deliver us, but even if he doesn't, it's important for us to remember. And that can even be true of you today. You might have something you know God wants you to do or not do, and you as a believer go ahead and do the right thing. You may suffer punishment, and God might protect you from that. He might not. He might let you go through the punishment to his glory. Or he might, to his glory, protect you from the punishment. We always think protection would be to his glory, but you know, sometimes the way a person faces something also can be to his glory. And so he goes on here in this chapter. He says in verse 3, for rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior. In other words, normally if you behave yourself, if you do the things you should do, normally it's not a fear for that. But the problem is we as Christians, we oftentimes get ourselves into trouble because we do the things that God has never told us to do. As I told you last week of the guy that says, I don't think Christians should pay taxes to an immoral government. What was the government of Rome, if not immoral? And yet Jesus told them even, pay your taxes. Paul tells them, pay your taxes. Peter tells them, pay your taxes. See? And so he says, for rulers are not a cause for fear, for behavior, but for evil. So if you don't want to have fear of the authority, then do what is good, and you'll have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. In other words, the purpose is, and this is, I think, important for us, part of the reason, how many of you go to bed at night worrying that the chances are 90% or above, or even 80% or above, that someone's going to kick in your door that night and you're going to have like a whole bunch of, a whole big mob of people that are going to rush in there at night and take all your possessions and beat you up? How many of you go to bed worrying about that? I hope hardly any of you worry about that. And it's not because maybe you keep a gun or something beside your bed or something like that. It's nothing to do with that. It's the fact that we live in a country in which they normally keep law and order, and they enforce that, and as a result, we don't have mobs just ranging all over the place just causing disaster. That's not true in some parts of the world. You go to places over there where the Ovenels are, they'll tell you that sometimes you've got these long drives where you're out in the middle of nowhere, long ways from any law enforcement. And you get people that'll stop you on the edge of the road and they will demand money from you at the end of a gun. And you'll have a huge mob of private soldiers or something that are just demanding money from you. And that goes on in many parts of the world. We can be really thankful that we don't live in that kind of a situation. Aren't you? Aren't you thankful that that's not the way you live? That Darren doesn't just pull you over in town and say, I'm going to haul you in unless you give me 50 bucks because I want to take my wife out for supper tonight. Give me 50 bucks. And you go, what did I do wrong? Well, you didn't do anything wrong, but I don't care. And there are parts of the world where they got soldiers are walking around. People don't like soldiers. In fact, I know a number of the people that come from Mexico, they come up here. They don't trust law enforcement because they come from countries where law enforcement aren't necessarily honest. So Paul's saying here for us, normally in verse 4, they are ministers of God for good. They actually are designed to bring about a sense of well-being. And generally we have a sense of well-being because I don't fear for my life on a daily basis. I don't fear for the well-being of my family on a daily basis because of all these things. But if you do what is evil, then be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God and is an avenger who brings wrath upon the one who practices evil. And so he tells us to be in submission. Some perspective on what we need to understand about what civil government does. It's not there to bring about God's righteousness, but it does bring about a type of human righteousness, human conduct. It's there to bring about a human sense of well-being. We can sleep at night, you know. You don't have to go to bed hugging your guns and things like that. Oops, I thought I had one more on there. One last passage I'd like us to look at. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Because sometimes we end up making use of things in the world system, and some of that may end up being civil government. We may, hey, if you want to build something, what do you have to do around here? You just don't go off and just we've got property down right down below the church. Why don't we, as a church, just go down there and we just build something, you know? There were several years ago, we were talking at church about building, they were talking about building a house. And one of the possibilities, well, we could go down there. Why didn't we just do that? Why didn't we just grade that off and just start building a house? Why didn't we do that? Because it belongs to somebody else. And there are laws in place that make it so that you just don't go on somebody else's property and just start randomly building. And I'm thankful for that because I don't have to worry about then my neighbors coming and saying, well, we're going to cut down your trees and build something on the front of your house. They don't do that. So you make use of the world system, right? We make use of it in a number of different ways. And so in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and look with me at verse 31. There's a number of things he's trying to put in perspective. He says, and those who use the world as though they did not make full use of it. In other words, you always remember, even when you make use of the world, there's always a limitation about what you're going to be able to accomplish. And you don't, in the end, make it an end in itself. And Christians, sometimes we have problems with this. There are Christians that sometimes we can get involved in government thinking we're going to make the world a better place. That is not our job as Christians to make the world a better place. We have one command, chiefly, and that's the command to show love to one another. And some of us can think, well, if I can get the world fixed, that's how I can love other people. You don't love other people by fixing the world. That's an erroneous concept. God's never, anywhere in the New Testament, ever says fix the world to love other people. You know how you love other people? You love them with the opportunity that God puts in front of you of doing something specifically for that individual. Now, maybe you go to somebody. Maybe you have somebody that comes along and they need some financial help. And you might say, okay, I've got some money in my pocket, but that's only going to get you through the day. So then I might end up calling Josh and say, hey, do you guys need some other help down there? I have a person here. Could I send them down there and see if, you know, maybe they could work for you or something like that? Though that might be something you're doing. And that's a part of the world system. But as you talk to Josh realizes running that business down there is not an end in itself. It's just one thing that God happens to have put in his path, and he does that. But what if it all ends tomorrow? If you make that an end to yourself, if for some reason everything goes topsy-turvy tomorrow and all comes to an end, then what do? You're like, ah! But if you learn whatever you're doing, whatever you make use of in the world, that you always remember that it has a limitation on what it can accomplish, what it can be the end outcome. Whether it has to do with human government in this sense or anything in the world system, you're going to be that person that's going to be able to continue doing the will of God, being at ease, as John says over in 1 John 2. You can be at ease out into the age because your life is not staked and snagged in the world system. It doesn't go up and down with the markets. It doesn't go up and down with whatever administration is in the White House or in Washington, D.C. You float. And you make use of those things, and every one of us does. I don't care who you are. We might think I'm not entangled. We all are. It's just the degree and the perspective we have towards those things. So I just think, again, kind of an opportunity for us to think a little bit about the limitations and what we can expect, what you can expect. I'm going to just, I don't want to drag this out a whole lot longer. Oh, we talked about that last week. The steward is Noah. And the household is all mankind, okay? Everybody is responsible for this, okay? But Noah and his sons would have been the steward. He would have been the steward, and he and his sons in doing this.
So last week you said it was thought that Noah was the steward of conscience.
No, Cain. Noah, Seth. Cain was the steward of conscience.
Okay.
Yeah, would have been, yeah. But Noah is the one that God gives the instructions to when they get off the ark. Okay. Okay. If you have any further questions on any of this, you can come and ask me afterwards. We'll close with a word of prayer. And Father, we're thankful as we look back at this time in history that we can see that even what we observe today is we see men unite to try to accomplish purposes, and oftentimes those purposes are rather apparent that they are against what you desire, what you really want with regard to people. They're not producing your kind of righteousness. Help us, as we look back in history, see it's nothing new, and to learn those limitations, to recognize that failure, to realize that our situation we are in today is because of the judgment that you brought on the world for their failure in that dispensation. And help us as we make use of the world, that we would always keep in perspective that there are limitations as to how far we can go into what can actually be accomplished. And that we would learn to focus more and more, not on how we're going to fix the world, but how we might be used in the life of maybe just that one person that you bring across our path in a day. And in that, that you can be glorified. We're thankful for this day. We're thankful for your word and the time that we've been able to spend together around it. Amen.